This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Halfway through the program, Saturday morning here in Peg City, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel and Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome to the program Keith Gave. Keith is a journalist from Detroit. He covered the Detroit Red Wings for a number of years, including, if I understand this correctly, Keith, that you were here in 96 for the penultimate Jets-Red Wings series prior to the Jets moving to Arizona. Author of a new book about the Detroit Red Wings' Russian Five. The book is called The Russian Five, A Story of Espionage, Defection, Bribery, and Courage. Keith Gave, welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thank you, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Doing very well, Keith. How about yourself?
Real good, thanks. Really. And yeah, I was just doing another radio appearance yesterday, and somebody asked me, the Wings were playing in Winnipeg last night, and somebody asked me if I had a favorite memory from my days traveling with the Red Wings and covering games at Winnipeg, besides the picture of the Queen at the one end of the Winnipeg Arena. You know, I covered the last game there, the last series that the Wings played there in 96, and it just struck me at the end of the game. Yeah, the Winnipeg Jets, the fans there, they lost the game. They lost a Stanley Cup playoff series. But they stood there. Many of them were in tears. I'll never forget it. They lost their hockey team that day. They were going to Phoenix, and it just, I remember it as one of the more emotional moments that I've ever had in my hockey career, seeing a city lose their hockey team. I'm thrilled that Winnipeg is back in the NHL.
I assure you the people of Winnipeg are equally as thrilled, Keith. Keith Gave is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the author of a new book called The Russian Five, A Story of Espionage, Defection, Bribery, and Courage. Keith, for any of our audience who might be on the younger side of things, they might not remember the Russian Five and how critical they were to the success of the Red Wings in the in the mid-90s, that, of course, being Sergei Fedorov, Vyacheslav Fedosov, Vladimir Konstantinov, Slava Kozlov, and Igor Larionov. They certainly were the players who made the Detroit Red Wings, and Russian hockey players are the norm nowadays. But back in the mid-90s, it wasn't so easy to get players of that ilk out of Russia, to get them into the NHL. We've heard some of the stories before of clandestine meetings and shuffling people in and out of espionage-like scenarios. You played a critical role in getting these players into Detroit. Can maybe you explain for our audience the role you played above and beyond that of just a reporter covering the Detroit Red Wings?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Ezra.
That was Drew, actually, Keith. I don't want you to get us confused because I'm obviously the better-looking one.
Right? Yeah, Ezzy's the better-looking one. I'm the more articulate one.
All right, guys. My apologies. When the Wings started drafting Russians, made a little history in the process. And in 1989, this was 6 years after they drafted Steve Yzerman. They really weren't making much progress building through the draft, which Jimmy Devilano, the general manager, had promised. They kind of hit a plateau. They knew they needed better players to build a team around Steve Yzerman. And they also knew that the best players in the world, some of the best players in the world, were behind the Iron Curtain in Russia, Czechoslovakia, and so on. And so they made a conscious decision in 1989. After they drafted Nick Lidstrom in the third round, they went back to Europe behind the Iron Curtain and drafted Sergei Fedorov in the fourth round, the highest a Soviet-born player had ever been drafted in the NHL. How about that? Back-to-back Hall of Famers in two drafts. They drafted Sergei in the fourth round. And they took a flyer in the 11th round and drafted Vladimir Konstantinov. Well, about a month or so after the draft, Jim Leitz, the executive vice president of the Detroit Red Wings, invited me to lunch. And in the middle of summer, it was really kind of odd because I never heard much from Leitz, who then was Mike Ilitch's son-in-law, unless they were mad at me for something I wrote in the Free Press that morning. And anyways, I met him for lunch, and he said, "Hey, we're wondering if you could consider doing something for us." And I was skeptical right away, but he said, "We know that you can speak Russian. I had spent 6 years in the U.S. Army as a Russian linguist during the Vietnam War. It kept me out of Vietnam, and that's why I went to Russian language school. But I worked for the NSA and got out of the Army, studied journalism, got in the newspaper business, wound up covering hockey. So the language served me well. But he said, we want you to go to Russia, or go to Helsinki. The Soviet national team is having a training camp there in August, and we're wondering if you go to Helsinki to one of those games that they play and maybe interview the players that we drafted, Fedorov and Konstantinov, and while you're interviewing them, pass along a message that we want to help them defect. Maybe you could write a letter for us, tell them we're willing to pay them this much money." They were willing to pay both those guys the same thing they were paying Steve Eiserman at the time, and also pay their parents a certain amount of money and so on. And the kicker was he offered me a lot of money to do that. And I said, "Time out, Jim. There's no way that I can do this for you. I cover your team for the Detroit Red Wings. I really can't do you any favors like that." And he said, "Okay, enough said." And we kind of let it go. And I just got to thinking, you know, beat guys, that make deals with their sources all the time. And I knew I was on a little bit of ethical thin ice, and I know I'll be criticized for this in some circles, but, and I also knew I'd spent enough, read enough books and seen enough spy thrillers to see how newsmen, AP, you know, Associated Press journalists and people from the New York Times, Washington Post, and so on, the Toronto Globe and Mail, wind up in the middle of these little things back and forth between the CIA and the KGB and so on. And anyways, I called Lights back and I said, "Look, maybe I can do this. I'm not going to take a dime for doing this. I don't want any money. I'll pay my own expenses. I'll go over there. I'll interview these guys. I'll pass along a message. I want one thing. I want one promise. When these guys defect and come over here, I want the news first for my readers of the Detroit Free Press. I want to interview them first. I want first crack at them in all ways possible." And Light said, "Deal." And a couple of weeks later, I was on my way to Helsinki, Finland, to meet up with Sergei Fedorov and Vladimir Konstantinov.
Now, Keith, you just mentioned, you know, two of the Russian Five members, Sergei Fedorov and Vladimir Konstantinov, and I think most hockey fans who followed hockey back then know how skilled the five players were, especially Fedorov. And one of my favorite members of the Russian Five on the Red Wings was Vyacheslav Kozlov. I always thought he was a very underrated player, and he went on to play for the Atlanta Thrashers, of course. But when you consider how revolutionary what Scotty Bowman was doing, putting out five Russian players, and I think you would agree with this, it was very similar to the style of play that you saw in the Central Red Army going back a few years with Vladimir Krutov and Sergei Makarov. Can you just talk about how revolutionary that was, what Scotty Bowman was doing by not only putting five Russian players on the ice at the same time, but the style of play that they brought to the Red Wings?
Absolutely. You know, Scotty had a pretty long history with the Soviet players. He coached against them a lot in international competition, and he always admired the way they played. He knew that they played a different game. He knew that they played in five-man units. He came to Detroit, and he had three young guys, really talented young guys, in Fedorov, Konstantinov, and Kozlov. And I agree with you completely about Kozlov. He gets overlooked, and you know, there's some pretty good insight into him as a person and as a player in the book that I'm excited to share as well. But Scotty came here with three guys, and if you remember, guys, he had a pretty good team his first season, 93-94. They were the number one seed in the West. They played the number eight seed in the San Jose Sharks. In the first round, San Jose Sharks were led by a guy named Igor Larionov, by the way, and Makarov also played on that line. But one of the most stunning upsets in the history of Stanley Cup hockey, San Jose, in their third year in the NHL, beat the favored to win the Stanley Cup, Detroit Red Wings, that year, upset them. And so Scotty had a good look at a real good look at Igor Larionov in that series. So anyways, a couple years later, a year or so later, he has a chance to trade for Slava Fetisov, who wasn't playing much in New Jersey at the time. He went to Jim Devolano and Ken Holland. The three of them kind of made up the management and personnel decision making of the Red Wings, but Scotty had the final say. He said, "I have a chance to pick up Batista. I want to trade a third round draft pick for him. Now here's a 35, 36, 37 year old defenseman not playing, and Scotty wants to give up a third round draft for him." Well, Devilano and Holland balked at it because that's a lot to give up for a defenseman like that. They wound up doing it, and so they got the Tisov. And then that was 95-96. They lost in the finals. They got swept in the finals by New Jersey in 95. The fall of 95, Scotty still sees a need to build his team and add more players. And he went to Devilano and Holland again and said, San Jose wants to trade Igor Larionov. I think we're going to make that trade. Well, what do you have to give up for him? They asked. And Scotty says, they want Ray Sheppard. Well, if you remember, guys, at the time, Ray Sheppard was one of the most prolific goal scorers in the league. He had a couple of 50-goal seasons. He was scoring not quite at will, but scoring a lot for the Detroit Red Wings at the time. Well, there was a lot of argument and debate, and Bowman stood up to them and said, "Look, you brought me here to win. You want to win or not? I want to make this trade." They let him make the trade. They got five Russians together now. Three forwards, two defensemen. Two nights later, October 27th, 1995, he threw them all over the boards at the same time against the Calgary Flames. Scotty knew one thing after watching all these Russians. They like to play in five-man units. That's when they're at their best. If you remember that game, anything about it, the Red Wings dominated the game. They won 3-0. The Russians scored two of the goals in that game, two of the three goals. Detroit outshot Calgary 25-8 in that game. They had the puck all night long. The eight shots that Calgary scored were the lowest in franchise history. The Russians had 15 of Detroit's 25 shots, everybody knows what happened after that. I mean, they dominated play whenever they were in the ice. They played keep away. The Detroit Red Wings became a puck possession team. You're kind of sick and tired of hearing about puck possession 20 hours later, but that's how everybody's been trying to play the game ever since. And, we all know what happened. They went on to win the Stanley Cup 97, 98, with those five Russians. And, they had a few of them, left over and won again in 2002.
Keith Gave is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Keith is the author of a new book called The Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage. Keith covered the Detroit Red Wings for the Detroit Free Press for a number of years. The book is also a new documentary film that's going to premiere in April. You can check more information via on Keith's Twitter feed, at Keith Gave. Keith, you talk about the performance of the Russian Five on the ice and how dominant they were. Besides that, I mean, this book is about more than just their performance on the ice. It's about the drama about getting them out of Russia and getting them out from behind the Iron Curtain. When the Soviet Union collapsed, was that sort of the tipping point that allowed these players to begin to venture their way into North America? And you talked about in your first answer about your role in meeting with them in Helsinki and assisting the Red Wings in getting the first, I guess, communication to these players. Was that the end of your role in trying to get them over into North America and into the Red Wings lineup, or was there more?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Behind the scenes.
That was the end of my dealings with that. I was left out of the loop, and I didn't want to even know anymore about it. All I told Lights was, I want to know when Fedorov gets over here. I want to be the first to know. But the fall of the Iron Curtain, the Berlin Wall in '89 was the beginning of it for a lot of people behind the Iron Curtain. But it wasn't necessarily so for the hockey players. Victor Tikhonov and Gushin, the general manager, they ran that program, with an iron fist. And even though the Russian citizens had a right to travel suddenly abroad, do whatever they had freedoms that had never existed in 75 years under communism, the hockey players didn't necessarily have those freedoms. And it took a lot for guys like Igor Larionov first, writing, he penned a 7,500-word story in a magazine called Aganyok, basically taking the whole program to task, especially Tikhonov and, Tikhonov especially, the way he treated his players and so on. And, for that, he was exiled from the team for a while. A short time later, Slava Vitisov again went public, with his, complaints. He too was exiled. Vitisov was sent, he was a major in the Soviet Red Army and was forced to leave the hockey team and go dress up in a military uniform, sit behind a desk as a major in the army. I said, what'd you do while you're serving in the military? He said, nothing. I just sat by a desk for, eight, 10 hours a day. And then I went home. The leaders of the program at the time, Vitisov and Lirianov, really kind of helped kick down the Iron Curtain in their own way. When Vitisov was exiled from the team, Lirianov, Makarov, and Krutov actually went to a TV station and, went public, on a live show late at night after a hockey game and, essentially said, you know what, if we don't get our captain back, we're not going to go play in the World Championships. And, Tikhonov finally cracked and, they got their captain back. They went out and won the World Championships. The deal was after that in 89, we win the World Championship, you got to let us go and play in the NHL. And after that, you started seeing the older Russians going over, coming over to the NHL. Makarov to Calgary, Krutov and Lirianov to, Vancouver. Vitisov and Kasatanov a little bit later, to the New Jersey Devils. The young guys had no such right to travel. They were still being sequestered, at the hockey camp there in outside of Moscow. And, they didn't have freedom to come to the NHL. They had to essentially defect, a few years later, 1990 actually is when, Sergei Fedorov, late summer of 1990, he defected from the Goodwill Games games were held in Seattle. The Soviet team was playing a game in Portland. He actually defected from Portland back to Detroit, but it wasn't easy. These guys, if they were active duty in the military, it was even harder. Fedorov had to wait until his, time in service was over. They wanted him to reenlist. They were going to give him the rank of lieutenant, make him an officer, make his life a little easier and so on. But he refused to reenlist in the service. So it made it a little bit easier for him to leave the country without being labeled a traitor. Vladimir Konstantinov, on the other hand, was a captain in the Red Army. He was also captain. He succeeded Vitisov as captain of the Red Army Hockey Club, and it was much, much harder for him to come over here. He actually had to get released from the army somehow, some way. And in order to do that, I think it's the most compelling story in the book. In order to do that, he faked cancer. He faked a cancer. In order to fake cancer, you have to have doctors go along with it. The Wings had a contact who went over there and spread a lot of money around, bribing doctors, including the biggest American car that was made at the time was a great big old Chevrolet Caprice. One of the doctors wanted a big American car. They got him a big Chevy Caprice. The doctors wound up signing documents that said Vladimir Konstantinov has a rare form of cancer that can't be treated. We recommend that he be released from the army because he's going to die. And they released him from the army. A few days after his release from the army, he left the country and came to Detroit.
Keith, final question for you here, and it doesn't have to do with the Russian Five, but what was it like for you last weekend to watch future Hall of Famer Pavel Datsyuk finally win that elusive gold medal? And then after the game, Datsyuk was quoted as saying that that gold medal means more to him than his Stanley Cups.
Well, I think that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody who's followed international hockey, especially the Russians. I remember talking to Viktor Tikhonov about this at Rendezvous 87 in Quebec when, instead of the All-Star game, if you remember, they played two games, the NHL All-Stars against the Soviet national team. And, you know, that was a team that had Fetisov and Larionov and all those other great players on it. But I remember talking with Viktor Tikhonov and asking him that very thing, you know, at some point your players are going to come over here and play for the Stanley Cup. What do you think that's going to mean to your players? You know, the Stanley Cup versus the world championship gold and Olympic gold and so on. And he just kind of smiled and gave sort of a condescending answer. I'll never forget it. He said, our players dream in gold, not silver. And, you know, silver meaning, you know, the Stanley Cup, obviously. You know, that didn't surprise me. I'm happy for Pavel Datsyuk. I think he became the 28th player to win triple gold, world championship, Olympic gold medal, and the Stanley Cup. But I can tell you this also, guys, that when Slava Fetisov and Igor Larionov won the Stanley Cup, it meant more to them than anything at that time, because that for them, that was the only thing that they had won in their illustrious careers, and winning the Stanley Cup was an incredible moment. And you remember 97 when they won that cup at Joe Louis Arena. You learn a lot about a hockey team when the captain skates the cup around and looks for somebody to hand it to. Everybody remembers Joe Sakic handing the cup to Ray Bourque in Colorado and so on. Well, we were all waiting for what Steve Yzerman would do with the cup when he made his lap around the rink. And he turned, he looked for Slava Fetisov, and he gave it to him. And what did Slava Fetisov do? He looked over at his buddy, Igor Larionov, said, come on, let's go. And the two of them skated the Stanley Cup around the ice together in one of the more, again, emotional moments I've ever encountered in my career covering hockey in the NHL.
Keith, one last quick question for you, and right up against it, Slava Fetisov, you went through the history of having to, having to challenge the Russian government and having to defect, and he was threatened and beaten by the authorities. Yet years later, he comes back to Russia as the Minister of Sport under Vladimir Putin. What do you make of the return of Slava Fetisov into the good graces of the Putin government?
Yeah, he's a senator in the Russian parliament and very close to Putin. If you ever see the clips of Vladimir Putin playing hockey, you know, skating around, scoring 8 goals in a game, whatever, and they take a picture of a group, Slava Fetisov is always right there next to him. You know, Slava Fetisov is a very proud Russian. He cares about his country, and I think it's pretty cool that he's back there doing that. I think he's a moderate. I think he understands the importance of good relationship between Russia and the West, Canada and the United States, and so on. He believes in the importance of sport to build bridges between cultures, and I think we need Slava Tisov there in that frame of mind. Look at Sergei Fedorov; he's back there as general manager of the Soviet or the Red Army Club that he defected from, and Slava Kozov is back there as assistant coach for Spartak, trying to get a coaching career started. I think it's pretty good.
Time heals all wounds. Keith Gave is the author of The Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage. It's available on March 20th on Amazon.com. You can pre-order it now. Get it wherever your favorite books are sold. Keith, appreciate your time this morning. It's a fascinating story. Thanks for sharing it with our audience.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Take care, Keith. Well, we're way out of time on our clock, so let's go to break, and we'll come back, and then we'll probably go to break again real quick. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Hour number 3 of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. This segment is brought to you by our friends at Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
To discuss the Boston Bruins, we're pleased to be joined by Mick Calagio. Mick covers the Bruins for a dial tone, apparently. We'll get Mick back on the line. We'll get Mick back on the line there in a second. But yes, he doesn't cover them for a dial tone. He covers them for
I don't think he liked the way you introduced him.
Apparently, he was just fed up with us. So he didn't like the idea that we had a sandwich named after us.
Oh,
or
that
something.
Was too good.
Yeah.
Mick wants a sandwich.
Maybe that's what we need. He needs to be paid with it for a sandwich. Now, Mick, are you there?
I am here now.
Yeah. There we go. You sound way better than you did as a dial tone, let me tell you.
We're having a power outage right now, so I apologize for any glitches along the way.
That's okay. We've had a power outage here on the show since 9 o'clock this morning when we got on air, but that's a separate issue altogether. Mick, obviously, we brought you on to talk about the Boston Bruins. You cover the Bruins for the Standard Times, and your blog can be reached at southcoasttoday.com. The Bruins sitting comfortably in second spot in the Atlantic Division. Probably locked in to play the Toronto Maple Leafs in the first round. They could conceivably catch the Tampa Bay Lightning. You know, do the Bruins have a first round preference as to who they meet in the first round? Do they want to catch Tampa Bay, or are they happy sort of being in that second spot and facing the Leafs in the first round of the playoffs?
Yeah, I think that they have to win the division in order to avoid the Maple Leafs. And right now the biggest question is probably home or away versus the Maple Leafs, and they have games in hand, but they have a very taxing schedule, and they're going to play it without Patrice Bergeron. So in all likelihood, they don't make up ground with these games in hand, even though they've had some spectacular wins of late. They have actually been pretty, they're not actually playing that well. They're competing well, and the new guys that they got at the deadline from top to bottom have been excellent for them, but
we may have lost Mick. Okay, we're going to work to getting Mick on the line again. Things are getting a little bit. So far, it's been a dial tone and then dead air with Mick. So
well, Mick also said there was a bit of a power outage.
Yeah,
he might have been joking. I'm not sure, but
I'm not 100% sure.
I'm pretty sure cell phones are immune from power outages, though.
I thought so, too. But we're working hard to get this interview to you on the... I can assure you that. Here's Rory working hard. Do we have Mick back on the line? No? Okay, we're going to try and get Mick. But the Bruins are playing good hockey, Ezzy, is what it boils down to. And they make their addition at the deadline in getting Rick Nash from the New York Rangers. And they go out and they really steamroll the Pittsburgh Penguins, doubling them up 8-4 a couple nights ago. So this Bruins team, sort of been under the radar all season long with how good they're playing, but they certainly have designs on being more than just a second-round opponent to the Tampa Bay Lightning. They feel as though that they can match up well against the Lightning in terms of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yeah, absolutely, and they just smoked Pittsburgh the other night 8-4. So, I mean, this team can score a lot of goals, and, you know, with Patrice Bergeron out of the lineup, I mean, they're going to need him come playoff time, but they've certainly got enough depth in the meantime. It's been very impressive what the Bruins have done here this year.
Mick, welcome back to the program. You were saying.
Yeah. So without Bergeron in this stretch, I think once the adrenaline wears off and after these initial spikes in performance that were also adrenaline laced from all the guys that got at the deadline, I don't see the Bruins out.
Looks like we may have dropped Mick again on the line. So we're going to see if... Mick, are you still there? No, it looks like the cell phone's cutting in and out. So we're going to try and see if we can get Mick on maybe with a better connection.
And maybe we'll try to get Mick on next segment.
Yeah, maybe next segment, or we'll try and get him on maybe next week if he's got a better connection. We'll see what's
going
on.
You want to go
to
the Hart Trophy discussion?
Why don't we save that and for a couple more minutes there, Ezzy. I want to do that at 11:15. I don't want to give that short shrift, the Hart Trophy discussion. But why don't we talk about the Seattle franchise?
Sure.
Because the Seattle organization, did a season ticket drive similar to what we saw here in Winnipeg a number of years ago when the Jets moved from Atlanta, similar to what we saw Vegas do with the Golden Knights and try and get drum up support in Vegas and get that season ticket commitment base there in Vegas. Well, they went gangbusters in Seattle, selling out or getting 10,000 season ticket deposits in a grand total of 12 minutes earlier this week.
I think they got close to 30,000 overall.
Overall, yes. I think that's what they ended up with in terms of number of inquiries. But they wanted that 10,000 benchmark, and they received that in 12 minutes. It's a foregone conclusion that...
I think the Jets got there in about 3, by the way.
Well, I mean, not surprised, really. But even 12 minutes in Seattle is pretty impressive because you're never certain that about the hockey market in Seattle because, they haven't had an NHL team in, almost 100 years, that sort of thing. The Seattle Metropolitans back in whatever it was, 1917 or whatever it might have been. The show of support goes to show you that this Seattle market is ready and they're going to be the next NHL franchise come 2020, 2021.
yeah, 3 years from now, Seattle's going to be in the league. And I wasn't surprised at all. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the NHL hockey has not been in Seattle since the early 20th century. But, you know, you've got the Seattle Thunderbirds there. And also you have that entire Washington State area.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes, by the way, BC.
Sure.
In those season ticket commitments, and we have no idea, I don't think, of knowing where these ticket deposits come from, but I wouldn't be surprised, Drew, if a lot of those ticket deposits, maybe not the majority, but a small minority, I would say, came from the British Columbia area, because you got to think, especially when you're talking about areas like White Rock,
sure,
areas that are on the border, there's a lot of people that'll make the drive down to Seattle. What is it, an hour, hour and a half drive? So obviously, you know, the interest is there, and we know that it's coming. I mean, there's no doubt that NHL hockey is coming to Seattle, as you mentioned. It's most likely going to be the 2020-2021 season.
If somebody's writing you a check for $650 million and it doesn't really cost you anything to bring them in, you're going to say thank you very much. That's a nice check to receive, you know, $20 million in the pockets of all the other 31 NHL owners.
And I believe 2020 is the year in which the arena is going to be completed, so it can't be before then.
They're renovating Key Arena. Key Arena for years was the home of the Seattle Supersonics.
That's
I think
right.
What it goes to show you, though,
and they want the Supersonics back
they
as well.
They do, certainly. Seattle was a great basketball town, and then they couldn't get the arena situation settled. And then
Sean Kemp, baby.
Well, that was back in Rain Man. Yeah, Sean Kemp, you're right, was a key member of the Supersonics. And then the team, of course, moved to Oklahoma City, where they're now the Thunder. But it goes to show you, Ezzy, that there's a lot of markets, I think, that might be a bit starved for professional, either hockey or professional basketball. And the reason I include hockey and basketball and not football or baseball is, well, baseball obviously runs in the summer, which is a different time period than hockey or basketball. And the NFL, which certainly sucks up all the oxygen, you really only play 8 meaningful home games a year. You know, you got a couple other exhibition games, but no one cares about that. So there is an opportunity, and there is room on the sports calendar, especially in a market like Seattle that wants 41 home games a year, that wants a significant, you know, something to do and something to keep your eye on and something to track throughout the course of, you know, December, January, February, March, you know, when football is done, when baseball hasn't really started up yet. And it goes to show you that, you know, the Seattle team, whatever they're going to be called, I think is going to be a success, at least off the ice, to start immediately. Whether or not they're going to be as good as Vegas has been this year.
How could you be?
Well, it's hard to believe you could be. I mean,
I like Seattle Sockeyes, by the way.
I know you mentioned that. Seattle, of course, is going to operate, by the sounds of it, under the same rules that the Vegas Golden Knights operate under. But, Ezzy, do you think that this is going to be the impetus to allow the NHL to maybe realign their divisions and maybe reshuffle their playoff format? We've talked about it on this show, that the playoff format needs to change to make the regular season more meaningful. Do you think the NHL might take the introduction of that 30-second franchise to do something along those lines?
Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, right now you have more teams in the Pacific, right?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, obviously
Seattle
one of the Pacific teams is going to have to leave.
Right. And, you know, Seattle is not going to go in the Central Division. I mean, for obvious reasons, it's on the West Coast. So when you look at, you know, who could possibly move to the Central, I mean, is it going to be Arizona? Is it going to be one of the Alberta teams? We know it's not going to be any of the California teams.
I think the easiest solution, I mean, there's twofold easy solutions. One, the Arizona Coyotes move to Houston, and then they play in the Central Division because that's the Central time zone. That makes the most sense. You're not going to split up Edmonton and Calgary. I mean, do you? I don't really know what your options are aside from doing something with Arizona, or they're the only team that could, you know, relatively seamlessly make the move into the Central Division. We know that the Colorado Avalanche are already a Central Division team that play in the Mountain Time Zone.
Right.
So unless you're not going to bring both the Oilers and the Flames into the Central Division, unless you move the Avalanche to the Pacific Division, which is a possibility,
yep.
I guess. You see the Flames and the Jets and the Oilers all as division rivals going back to the old Smythe Division. But I wonder if the Canucks would be upset about being a lone Canadian team in the Pacific Division.
Yeah, but there are changes coming. And, you know, you mentioned there always is the possibility of relocation, especially when you talk about the Coyotes. I think they are really the only team right now that are in danger of moving. Obviously, the NHL is not going to admit that.
Yeah.
But the Coyotes are doing horrible both on and off the ice. I don't know if you've seen the attendance numbers.
I'm sure they're horrendous. Why would you go?
Exactly.
I mean, why would you go watch a lousy hockey team play in a, you know, drive an hour from where your house is in Scottsdale? A
lot of empty seats there. So I agree with you. It makes the most logical sense for Seattle to join the Pacific, and then you have one of the teams from the Pacific move to the West, because then you have eight teams in the Pacific, eight teams in the Central.
As we go to break, though, as let's hear from, this is Farhan Lalji of TSN alongside Tim Lewicki and Jerry Bruckheimer of the Seattle NHL organization. This is what they had to say with regard to the 10,000 season ticket deposits in only 12 minutes.
With the two men, we're very enthusiastic about the possibility of bringing Seattle an NHL franchise, Jerry Bruckheimer and Tim Lewicki. Let's start with you. I know you've got some good news around the team.
Well, we do. We're shell-shocked, I guess, is the best way to put it. We sold 10,000 season tickets in 12 minutes, and we're at just short of 25,000. So I guess that's done, and Seattle's spoken, and the fans in Seattle have made it a resounding vote, which is they are ready for the National Hockey League, and they are counting on us to get the National Hockey League here.
The National Hockey League will likely return to Seattle in 2020-2021. When we come back, we'll discuss the Hart Trophy race, as it's been a fascinating battle, and it only continues to be more fascinating as we enter the last month of the regular season. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
March 1st, we're less than 6 weeks from puck drop in the Stanley Cup playoffs, and with bubble teams jockeying for position, potential individual award winners are also into the final push to impress the voters. The Hart conversation has to begin in the Sunshine State. Nikita Kucherov leads the scoring race with 82 points, and he's led it for 79 straight days.
You just try to get him the puck as much as possible.
Evgeny Malkin is second in scoring. One of three pens in the top 12. His 76 points are six better than Kessel, seven better than Crosby, and the most he's scored since he won the Art Ross back in 2012.
Taylor Hall is on an amazing stretch.
Taylor Hall has recorded a point in every game he's played in 2018. 22 straight. 27 points better than anyone else on the doubles, leading them to a wild card spot right now. Any doubt where they'd be without him?
Gino Retta of TSN's That's Hockey talking about the Hart Trophy battle, a fascinating race as we enter into the final month of the NHL season. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN 1290, and this segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For over 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit RumorsComedyClub.com. If you're looking for something to do tonight, Ryan Dalton is at Rumors. He's been there all week playing to sold-out shows. Tickets available. Not that many tickets, I understand. Two shows tonight. Tickets available. RumorsComedyClub.com. Ezzy, the MVP race continues to heat up in the NHL, and of course, it always leads to the semantic argument about valuable versus outstanding, because it is the most valuable player, as in most valuable player to their team in the entire league, as opposed to the most outstanding player in the general league. Right now, is it Nikita Kucherov in your mind, or, you know, is it a guy like Taylor Hall, who undoubtedly, Kucherov, you know, the Tampa Bay Lightning are a great team, Stamkos, Shen, you know, they've all been playing terrific hockey. But Taylor Hall on New Jersey is head and shoulders more valuable than anybody else in that roster.
Yeah, Taylor Hall's point streak has been phenomenal. He's up to 29 goals now. And I think with Nikita Kucherov leading the way with 82 points, he has to be one of the three finalists. But when you're talking about Evgeny Malkin, Nathan MacKinnon, Claude Giroux, Johnny Gaudreau, Blake Wheeler, I think you can make the argument he should be one of the three finalists. I think this is the best Hart Trophy race maybe in the last 10 years. I really believe that. Considering that Connor McDavid, we knew he was going to win the Hart Trophy last year for the Edmonton Oilers. And this year, I think you could throw in as many as maybe 12 or 13 players. A lot of people have been throwing out Marc-Andre Fleury. What about William Karlsson?
Sure.
35 goals. He's on pace to surpass 40 goals. What about Jonathan Marchessault? He's at a point per game right now. He's up to 42 assists.
What about
on the season?
Johnny Gaudreau?
I mentioned Johnny Gaudreau. What about Anze Kopitar?
Sure.
I mean, where would the LA Kings be right now with Anze Kopitar? He looks like the Anze Kopitar of 5 or 6 years ago.
Sure.
So I think you could go really deep as far as how many players are in the Hart Trophy conversation right now. And, you know, it's pretty amazing. Steven Stamkos might not even be one of the three finalists, and he's been phenomenal for the Lightning alongside Nikita Kucherov this year. So I think it's great for hockey that you have this many players in the Hart Trophy race right now, because most years, you know, there are maybe 4 or 5 players, maybe 6 or 7, that are in the Hart Trophy conversation. But this year, it's so close. You don't have one player that's, I think, really pulled away from the pack.
For players who have significant running mates, Kucherov and Stamkos, Malkin and Crosby and Kessel, do they get docked points in your mind as it pertains to the most valuable player race?
No.
So you don't think that they deserve, you don't think that because they play on a great team with great line mates or great players around them, that it diminishes their greatness?
To play devil's advocate, you could argue that they make those players better.
Absolutely, you could.
Right? And you could say that about Blake Wheeler. I mean, Nathan MacKinnon plays with two really good players in Mikko Rantanen and Gabe Landeskog. So it's not like he's playing with a couple of slouches, right?
Right. But I would argue that Landeskog and Rantanen aren't at the level of Stamkos or Crosby or Kessel, you know, when you look at it pertaining to Kucherov and Malkin.
Right, but you're talking about, you know, the best players in the league, right?
Should Connor McDavid, I mean, you know, Connor McDavid won last year. He's third in the NHL in scoring. He's playing on a horrendous Edmonton team. Should he get more attention, or is it just a function of the team in Edmonton is so bad this year that he almost is disqualified as a result?
You rarely see Hart Trophy finalists on teams that don't make the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Connor McDavid will get some consideration. I don't know if he ultimately becomes a finalist, because right now, if you're asking me who the favorites are, I'd say Kucherov, Malkin, and probably MacKinnon, and then Taylor Hall maybe is number 4. Blake Wheeler might be 5 or 6. But it's pretty incredible that in any other year, Blake Wheeler would most likely be a slam dunk as a finalist. But this year, it's been incredible. We have so many players having great seasons. And, you know, it's going to be tough, you know, for there to be a 100-point scorer this year. I mean, Kucherov, he's definitely going to get to 90. Yeah. He might get up to 95. He's at 82 points right now.
He's got to get a point a game over the last 19 games.
Yeah, and he can do it. I mean, he's a point a game right now. He's over a point a game, actually. Well over a point a game. So it can definitely happen. But, you know, the point is, I don't think you're going to see a player win the scoring race by 10 or 12 points. It's going to be close right down to the end of the season. But, you know, I think it's a great conversation, a great water cooler conversation, you know, who should be in the MVP discussion. How can you not have Taylor Hall as a finalist right now, what he's done? I mean, I don't think the Devils are in a playoff spot without him, but you could say the same thing about, you know, some of the other players we've mentioned. Johnny Gaudreau, would the Flames be close to a playoff spot? Probably not.
I don't think enough attention is being made to the streak that Taylor Hall is in the midst of. A point in every Devils game since the calendar flipped to 2018. I mean, that's been over 2 months now that he's got a point in every single Devils game in this year. I mean, it's sort of a bizarre stat, because nobody really, you know, tracks that sort of thing.
Well, how about another guy that we talked about earlier, Eric Staal?
Sure.
He's obviously not going to be one of the finalists, but 33 goals, 64 points for the Wild. He's been incredible.
There's been some superlative performances this year on the individual side of things. Some players who have sort of strapped teams to their back and carried them maybe further than you'd expect. Taylor Hall being the prime example there in New Jersey. You know, what Blake Wheeler did for the Jets when Mark Scheifele was out of the lineup was incredible. Johnny Gaudreau in Calgary, even though the Flames have really struggled as of late, the Flames losing last night to the New York Rangers. I don't know if you saw Johnny Gaudreau go a little bit nutty earlier in the week, earning the 10-minute misconduct when the Flames had their meltdown. I'm trying to think who that was against. That was earlier this week. I can't remember who their opponent was in that game, but it was a game they should have won and they lost as a result. You mentioned Eric Staal. You know, there's been some really impressive performances this year by players who are sort of just dragging their team towards the finish line of the season.
There's no clear-cut favorite right now.
I would agree with you.
I think you most can make people a lot of would arguments. Say Kucherov, but I really don't even know if he is a clear-cut favorite.
Well, I don't think he's clear. If he doesn't win the
point
race...
I'll agree that he's the favorite.
If he doesn't win the point race, I don't think he wins the MVP.
I think you're right.
I think he has to win the points race, and even then, I think a lot of voters might be inclined to give it to a guy like Nathan MacKinnon. If MacKinnon can be within striking distance...
76 points, Drew, in 56 games.
That's what I'm saying.
What is that, 1.3 points per game? I don't have my calculator right now.
1.36. He's got the most, you know, of players who've played significant time this year. He has the most points per game played. Of course, he missed that sort of that two-week, three-week stretch with that injury where he missed those two games here in Winnipeg. You know, if Nathan MacKinnon is within striking distance of Nikita Kucherov at season's end, and if he can drag the Avalanche into a playoff spot, I could see...
He'll at the very least be a finalist.
Oh, a finalist for sure. I think right now he's a finalist. I think he could end
Well,
up...
I think there's a lot of hockey to be played.
Right. But I mean, right now, as we sit here with, you know, a month to go in the regular season...
Well, that's the thing, Drew. I don't even... not only do I not think there's a clear-cut favorite, I don't think there are clear-cut finalists.
Really?
That's how close it is.
Okay, so you don't think...
I mean, obviously Kucherov would be in there.
Yeah.
And I would probably throw in Malkin in there as far as the favorites.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you not have Taylor Hall in there? How do you not have Claude Giroux in there?
Well,
how do you not have Blake Wheeler in there?
We haven't even spoken about Claude Giroux. I mean, he's having sort of a resurgence for the Philadelphia Flyers this season after a couple, I mean, not down years, but he wasn't Claude Giroux-esque that we have seen over the last, you know, at certain points in his career. The Flyers, you know, they sit second in the Metropolitan Division. They're only a point behind the Washington
Capitals. We haven't even
talked
about Alex Ovechkin. He's on pace for 50 goals.
Oh, I mean, he always scores 50 goals. So tell me what you've done for me recently is more or less the problem with that. Is there are certain players whose spectacular performances have just become old hat. And that's part of the problem with those players. Not the problem, but they sort of don't receive the credit that they should because we're used to seeing them put up the 50 goals in Ovechkin's case. Or the,
he had 33 last year.
Well, I know, but that was such a down year for him that even though this year, or in a lot of seasons, 33 goals is a career year for a lot of players. You know, but you know, Ovechkin's having a great year in Washington, a Washington Capitals team that, again, nobody's talking about despite the fact that they're atop the Metropolitan Division, because for them it only matters what you do in the playoffs.
How many years have we been able to say there are 12, 14, 15 players in the conversation in early March? I don't remember a year since we've been doing the show.
I think the difference is there's probably been years we've been able to do that, but I think that's because the it has been down years. That, you know, it's so wide open because the performances haven't been great by anybody, as opposed to this year, where the performances have been really good by a lot of players. I think that's the slight difference in that is that there are guys who are getting you up off your seat. I mean, you saw the Tuesday game between the Jets and the Predators, Ezzy. That was two world-class teams playing against one another. And this year, there are sort of those upper echelon teams. I think you can say the Jets and the Predators in the Western Conference and the Lightning and the Bruins in the Eastern Conference, or the Lightning and the Penguins in the Eastern Conference, are head and shoulders above everybody else that's playing. So you have, I think, five, maybe six legitimate Stanley Cup contenders, but everybody else is a notch below them. So when those Stanley Cup contenders play against each other, like we saw on Tuesday night with the Jets and the Predators, or like we saw with the Bruins and the Penguins, even though it was an 8-4 game, the offenses that are on display cannot be held back by the defense. The defense can't stop the offensive prowess that you're seeing on the ice, which makes it be like 1980s hockey, which just means talented hockey, as opposed to the dregs of the games we see so often when you're talking about, you know, teams that have one or two really good players and the rest is just sort of plug-and-play average talent that drags so many games down in this day and age in the NHL.
Yeah, having said that, any of the 16 teams that make the playoffs have a chance.
I don't believe that this year. I understand what you're saying, and I totally get the perspective where you're coming from, but I don't believe that is the case this year. I think that the cream is going to rise to the crop.
We'll see.
Of course we'll see. I mean, that's always how it is. I mean, the number of times I've been wrong is, you know, it can't even count that high. But I think, to me, the upper echelon teams are that much better than... You're not going to see a Nashville come in at eighth place like they did last year and make a run to the cup finals.
It's because they're in first.
I know, but you're not going to see whoever finishes eighth come in and make a run.
Well, you don't know that. We'll see.
We'll see, but I'm willing to bet this year that's not going to happen.
It's possible. It's not possible.
Thank you for your insight into that.
Well, I mean, you can't say that you don't have a shot.
It's true. You don't. Anson Carter of NHL on NBC is going to join us next. I think he might even be on the line. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Welcome back to TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the NHL on NBC, we're pleased to welcome back to the program a good friend of ours, Anson Carter. Anson joins us from Los Angeles, where he's getting set for tomorrow's Academy Awards. Hey there, big shooter. That's a pretty nice gig you got on your line.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. I'm pretty fortunate. I've got friends in high places. One of my good friends, Tom Bernard, is one of the co-presidents at Sony Picture Classic. So I usually tag along with TB to the Oscars or Cannes Film Festival or Toronto Film Festival or Sundance. It's great.
Well, that's there's the Gimli Film Festival here in Manitoba. If you really want to, you know, check out some independent films every summer, you can watch a movie on the beach, I believe, by the lake.
I might have to put that on my docket then. That's good to know.
There you go. Anson, always appreciate your time, and thank you for joining us.
Hold on,
morning.
We have to ask Anson who he's going to be wearing tomorrow.
Oh, yes, of course. Who are you going to be wearing tomorrow?
You know what? I'm still a last-minute decision. You know, I'm kind of going back and forth between Versace and a couple of independent tailors out here in California. So it's TBD, as I like to say in show business.
If you're curious, I'm going to be wearing my finest Roots sweatpants and a T-shirt that's stained with mustard.
You know, as a Canadian, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not too shocked.
Anson, obviously we brought you on to talk a little hockey. You know, the trade deadline came and went just about 6 days ago, and you know, it was always an exciting day for us here on the radio and for those of us in the hockey business. From your perspective, after the trade deadline dust has settled, is there a new top contender for the Stanley Cup, or you think the best teams just maybe got better and it's going to be a battle between those upper echelon clubs come April?
Yeah, I think the top teams just got better. I don't think anyone came with a trade deadline, you know, thinking to themselves, wow, like we put ourselves over the top. You know, when I think about teams like the Nationals and the Winnipeg that you guys are familiar with there in the Western Conference, they made some really key moves. But you go out east, you think about Tampa Bay, how they bolstered their defensive core and got JT Miller, you know, from the Rangers. And you have the Boston Bruins acquiring Rick Nash and, you know, and Wingles and just adding more depth with Gionta. So I don't think anyone really turned their season around. I just think the top teams in the National Hockey just got even stronger, and it'll be that much more difficult to come out of the East and the West.
You know, Anson, you just mentioned Rick Nash. You actually played with Rick Nash back in 2006, 2007 as a member of the Columbus Blue Jackets. How did you think that Rick Nash handled this whole situation? Because it's been pretty clear here for the last 3 or 4 weeks that the New York Rangers were going to trade Rick Nash.
I mean, it was very Rick Nash-esque. Yeah. If you know Nash, you're not that surprised. He handles class. Like he's a pretty quiet guy. You know, for a player that attracts so much attention on the ice, like he tries his best not to attract any attention whatsoever. I know, I remember playing with Nash, and even just walking to the Rangers dressing room, even now, is like going there just to cruise through so guys can see my face. He's so quiet. Like you never even realize that he's there. And that's like one of the best parts about him, I guess, getting acquired here at the trade deadline late in the season, because you don't want to have anyone come in your room that, you know, isn't a good guy. Because it's just so hard to get assimilated like really fast, and that transition has to be seamless. So I don't have any, you know, fear at all of Rick Nash, you know, getting assimilated in that Boston Bruins lineup. But also, too, his two-way game is very underrated. Yeah, he hasn't scored as much as he had in the past, but he's been able to reinvent himself as a two-way player. So if he wasn't making as much money as he was making, we'd be talking about Rick Nash being, you know, a heck of a player. But the fact he's making so much money, we're thinking, oh, his production stinks, so therefore we need to move him.
Anson Carter is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Anson is, of course, with the NHL on NBC. And it was last Sunday, Anson, you were in the analyst chair next to Doc Emrick calling the game between the Predators and the Blues. I guess sort of a two-part question. One, what was it like being the analyst on the game as opposed to being in the studio? And two, the Nashville Predators, a team we all know very well here in Winnipeg, given that they're battling with the Jets for the top of the Central Division. What did you think watching the Predators up close and personal? How impressed were you with their performance?
Well, first of all, it was awesome working next to Doc. Like, I had no idea because we had all of our crew in South Korea, and I was in the studio for the Olympics with our men's and then Tessa. Bonham was there with the women. and Erica Lawler. So we were having, you know, early mornings. They had the late nights in the studio. So when I was called to, you know, ask if I wanted to sub in and, you know, call a game, because I usually do all the college games here on NBC in the United States, I didn't think twice about it. And then I found out literally like the day before on a text message with the producer of the game, Tim Papps from the St. Louis Fox, that for Fox Midwest, who was producing the game, had texted me, and the group text with Darren Pang and Doc, and I was like, think to myself, like, why is Doc on this text? And it finally came to hit me. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm calling the game with Doc. This is awesome. So it was definitely a highlight of my very short broadcasting career, that's for sure. And I had the opportunity to work with Dave Strader and call the outdoor game here in California between the Ducks and the Kings, and I sat up in the Vin Scully booth, which I thought was awesome too, being a big time baseball fan. So to work a game alongside Doc was awesome. And, you know, having the St. Louis Blues and the Nashville Predators, who I thought would be a good matchup before the game started, a good Central Division matchup, I thought would be awesome. But seeing that Nashville team, watching them on TV is one thing, and I saw them up close and personal during the finals, and we call our pre-games on location, is impressive. But seeing them this year, like, there's no weaknesses. Their goaltending, Pecorine, is outstanding. You've got the defenseman on the back end, second and none in the National Hockey League. And then P.K. Subban, I believe, is having a Norris Trophy-type year. And then up front, like down the middle, I thought was the biggest weakness between the Nashville Predators and Ryan Johansson got hurt last year in the Pittsburgh Penguins. Now they've got Bonino, Johansson, Watson, I mean, Turris. I mean, they're just so strong everywhere. And they've got grit in Hartman and Hartnell. You got speed in Arvidsson. You got skill in Fiala. Like, how do you want to play like the Nashville Predators could play you?
Anson, last segment, Drew and I were going back and forth about the Hart Trophy and who we think, you know, the candidates are right now. And when you consider what Nathan MacKinnon is doing and what Taylor Hall is doing, Claude Giroux, do you remember a Hart Trophy race being this close in recent memory?
I don't. I really don't. I mean, what these guys are doing is, it's just blowing my mind. You could kind of go down the whole league and try to figure out, you know, there's a guy from every single team, like Eric Staal. I mean, Eric Staal, the first time with 30 goals in, you know, over 7 years. Like, we thought that Eric Staal was done. You know, we're throwing roses on his grave. And all of a sudden, Eric Staal is being back to being a dominant, you know, first-line center, which you're like, oh, my gosh, how did this happen? You've got Kopitar, same exact thing, and L.A. having a nice resurgence there. You mentioned Nathan MacKinnon, Taylor Hall. Like, these are all players that just going to make things very, very difficult when you're thinking about the Hart Trophy. And it's too bad that Patrice Bergeron went down, because he's in that conversation as well. So I wouldn't want to be on that panel picking, you know, the Hart Trophy, because, you know, you're thinking you're picking favorites and the perennial guys every single year, but you've got a lot of new faces in there, which is also nice to see.
Anson Carter's our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Anson is, of course, an analyst for the NHL on NBC. You know, Anson, as much of the story at the trade deadline was the players who got traded, the story of the players who didn't get traded was just as important. You know, we have the Erik Karlsson saga in Ottawa, you know, Max Pacioretty and Alex Galchenyuk in Montreal, other players from around the league, you know, that were rumored to be on the block. When you're a player and you know that your team has talked about trading you, and that trade doesn't come to fruition, what's it like going back into that dressing room knowing that you were this close to maybe being with a Stanley Cup contender, or you were this close to getting a refresh to your career when you were, at least in the case of, you know, Pacioretty, where we're really sort of actively looking forward to that opportunity?
Well, you know what? You have to be a pro. That's first and foremost. Like, you learn really early that this is the job. And, you know, people keep saying, well, you know, why didn't he do that, or why didn't he do this? And I wish I could play in the National Hockey League. Well, you got to be a pro. That's the first thing. So if you approach it from being a pro, then you just go about your day and you prepare how you're supposed to prepare every single day. But I'm not going to lie to you. It's a pretty crappy feeling, you know, knowing a team didn't want you, because there's two parts of the trade. Either a team wants you or a team doesn't want you. And having that in the back of your mind, knowing that the team that you're playing for didn't want you and they're looking to get rid of you for another player, it's not very fun. And thankfully, you've got some solid guys in every single team's dressing room that, you know, helps rally around you. And then you forget really quick that you were on the trade block. But it's not a very good feeling. And it's, you know, the part about sports I don't really like. And, you know, I always hate when people keep talking about, well, you guys make so much money. Well, that's not fun. If you get traded, if you have a family, sometimes guys get traded and they don't see their family all season long, because you have to think about your kids, and your kids are, you know, still in school, or you don't see your wife, your girlfriend, or whoever it might be.
So that's probably the crummy part about it. And being in Canadian markets like Max and Alex are, I think that makes it even worse. Because I really think that the media in Canada has a lot more power than the fans really think. And that's the reason why you don't see a lot of guys want to play in Canada. Like, I don't care what anyone says. I'll always hear my friends back in Toronto talking about, oh, we should try to get this player, get that player. I know for a fact that I played against and I played with a lot of Hall of Fame guys. A lot of Hall of Fame guys that I talked to, I knew there was no chance in the world they'd play in Canada. No chance. So every time they became free agents and the possibility came out, I'd always hear like the hot stoves and everyone talking on the radio and in the tea leaves. I read the tea leaves all the time. And I guess now it's the internet now. And there's all the speculation about this player coming to Canada, this player. I was always thinking to myself, there is no chance in the world this year to sign in Canada. Because the organizations give a lot of times the media free rein to rip guys. And guys in the league talk about that stuff. So Max Pacioretty, he's a perfect example, how he's getting carp Montreal nonstop. Like, he's become the scapegoat. And that could easily be shut right down by the organization saying, hey, Montreal Gazette, that's not happening. This is our guy. And it doesn't happen there. So if you don't have strong management shutting that stuff down, then it's going to filter down towards the players. It's going to have a negative effect on the players. You look at the Toronto Maple Leafs, when Lou Lamoriello and Shanny are there now, and Babs are there. You don't see those stories coming out about guys. It's strictly about the game, and that's it. Nothing else. There's no speculation. There's nothing else. It's strictly breaking down the game and how guys are playing. If guys are playing poorly, then the media will talk about it. If they're not, they're going to talk about it. There's no other side stories that are coming up. And that's how it has to happen in Canada. And in some of those markets, that isn't the case, unfortunately. I mean, that's the ugly truth that nobody wants to talk about.
Anson, we wanted to ask you about the 2018 Winter Olympics that recently concluded in Pyeongchang, South Korea. And obviously, you know, you scored one of the most famous goals of all time back in 2003 at the World Hockey Championship. What was your overall thoughts of the Olympics and Canada's performance specifically?
I thought the Olympics were great. You know, I'm a purist, so I don't care whether NHL players are playing or not. I've seen firsthand the World Championships, where you would have a guy playing the national hockey team who's a pretty good player, and then he puts his country's jersey on, his sweater on, and he'll block a puck with his face. You know, whether it's an NHL, he might not block that puck. So I saw firsthand how playing for your country, you take things up to a whole different level. So I wasn't really that shocked to see guys get motivated to play for their respective countries. So I thought every single game was captivating. I thought there was drama every single game. I know going in, some people thought that Russia was favorites without a doubt, but I didn't think that was the case. and even Marco Sturm's team in Germany, if they didn't screw up late in that hockey game, we could be talking about the Germans coming away with a gold medal. Like, every single game I thought was compelling. I thought was great hockey, and you just didn't know. And as I look at Canada and how they performed, I didn't think they were gold medal favorites. I thought potentially they could have medaled. Like, whenever you have a Canadian team when your best player is your goaltender, and it's not a knock against Canadian goaltenders, because there's been a lot of great Canadian goaltenders, you're never in for, you're not going to have a long run. And I thought Ben Scrivens, I looked down the Canadian roster, I thought he was Team Canada's best player. And Ben Scrivens is a good goalie. He's not a great goalie, but he's a good goalie. And he would really have to play out of his mind to lead Canada to a medal or to a gold medal, and that definitely wasn't the case.
Anson, we'll let you go on this last question. January was the 60th anniversary of Willie O'Ree breaking the color barrier in the NHL, and lately there's been a significant push and momentum to see Willie O'Ree get into the Hockey Hall of Fame. From your perspective, is that a long overdue honor, and do you think that this momentum that's now existing is going to be the catalyst that gets Willie O'Ree inducted into the NHL or into the Hockey Hall of Fame?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, I started the push, I think it was last year, to start the conversation about Willie being a builder. And, you know, and I have conversations with my friends growing up from Toronto, and they're shocked. Like, they thought he was in already. And the other side, people, you know, their argument right away is, well, he didn't play enough games in the NHL. Well, he was supposed to be a builder, not a player. Like, not only did he play in the National Hockey League, but he spent the last 20 years growing the game. If you saw how much the game has grown, like, here in L.A., it's been awesome. Like, you can't find ice to rent here in L.A. It feels like you're in Winnipeg. It feels like you're in Toronto. You can't find ice. And it's not because of the shortage of rinks. There's all these kids that are playing, boys and girls playing, men and women playing the game of hockey. So I look at Wayne Gretzky, and Wayne Gretzky's trade to L.A. was a big factor. Like, that would be the seed that really started this explosion of hockey. But I see Willie as being the guy that watered that seed. Like, he's on the plane every single week talking to kids. Hockey's for everyone. He's, you know, been involved with over 100,000 kids. I think it's been over 120,000 kids over the last 20 years, instructing them, teaching them about the benefits of playing hockey, teamwork, dedication, leadership, getting together, cooperation, like all the little things that we learned growing up in Canada that hockey gives you. That's exactly the message that Willie's been teaching these kids. It's not necessarily to play in the National Hockey League. It's to play hockey for fun, for fitness, to hang out with your friends. So from that standpoint, if you're looking at Builder and you see what Builder really means, like that fits Willie O'Ree to a T. So absolutely, I think it's long overdue. My fingers are crossed that he gets in. Willie isn't getting any younger. So I'd rather Willie get in now while he's still with us than wait 10 years and you never know what's going to happen. Like Pat Burns, I was always thinking before, like Burnsy was a Hall of Fame coach. So why wait till Pat Burns is gone before he gets inducted? Why not induct him while he's still with us?
Well, Anson, we agree with you 100%. I had a chance back in 2013 when the draft was in New Jersey to meet Willie O'Ree, and he's one of the nicest people I've ever met, and he had so much time to give to us, and I think, you know, I speak for everybody here at the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I think we would definitely love to see him in the Hockey Hall of Fame.
100%. I'm with you guys. I mean, that's why I come on your guys' show every single time you guys ask me, because we share the same frontal lobe.
Anson Carter is an NHL analyst for the NHL on NBC, joins us from Los Angeles, where he's getting set for tomorrow's Academy Awards. Anson, thanks so much for joining us. We know it's a busy day for you, and have a great time tomorrow and enjoy the after parties as well.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Take care, Anson.
Take care.
When we come back, one final segment, we'll look around the NHL, some news and notes. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca. NHL news and notes.
Can't forget that, producer Rory. That's why you get paid the big bucks to hit that NHL news and notes button. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel and Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. Dave Manuk away from the program. I believe he's on a sewing retreat this week, if I'm not mistaken.
I thought it was a yoga retreat.
No, yoga and sewing. It's a combination of the two of them. Dave will be back with Ezzy next Saturday morning. Patrick Hornqvist.
Six in the morning, by the way.
Six in the morning next Saturday. Enjoy that. I'm on holidays. I'll probably be up, though, to be honest. My kids... We're going to be out on the West Coast in the Pacific time zone.
You're going to be up at 4?
It wouldn't shock me knowing the time change in young children, and something you will very, very soon realize, Mr. Ginsberg, yourself, that kids don't know necessarily about what time you want them to be up. They just get up when they want to be up. So you look forward to that. You know, this is just a test for you to wake up at 6 in the morning when little baby Ginsberg is on their way here in the next few months. Patrick Hornqvist, as he signs a 5-year, $26.5 million contract extension with the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Yep.
It's an average annual value of $5.3 million. Your thoughts on that contract for Hornqvist to remain a member of the Penguins? Certainly doesn't get the publicity that the Kessel, Crosby, Malkin players do, but he's certainly a key member of that team.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised that he got 5 years.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I mean, you know, Patrick Hornqvist is not a young player. What is he, 31 years old, 32 years old?
Sounds about right. He's certainly played with the Nashville Predators for a number of years, and then got traded to the Penguins in the James Neal trade,
and, you know,
going back a number of years
ago.
For
me, Drew, you know, Hornqvist on this team kind of plays the role of Thomas Holmstrom back in the day for the Detroit Red Wings. I mean, we know who drives the bus offensively.
Sure.
It's Malkin, it's Crosby, it's Kessel. And, you know, with Hornqvist, I mean, for a guy who, you know, he's going to give you most likely 20 goals, 50 points year after year, I don't have a problem with this contract in year one or year two. But I think when you get into years three and years four, you know, when Patrick Hornqvist is 34, 35 years old, I don't know if you want to be paying him, you know, $5 million a year, but that's just me.
Yeah, plays a physical game, so
exactly.
The wear and tear, and the Penguins always play deep into the playoffs.
And he's missed some hockey over the years, and, you know, he's missed a little bit of time here this year, but, you know, over the years, he's missed some hockey, so I think that's something to factor in as well. But, you know, Hornqvist gives you that depth scoring. And he gives you that physicality, as we talked about. And he's a player, you know, that has played a pretty key role on the Penguins over the years in the playoffs. He's not a guy that necessarily, as you mentioned, gets a lot of the headlines because you have the Kessels and the Crosbys and the Malkins and the Letangs mm-hmm. getting the majority of the accolades. But, you know, Hornquist is a very solid player. I just was a little bit surprised that they gave him that many years.
Yeah, with that many years and that dollar figure, you figure if they're going to go 5 years, maybe they could save a little on the AAV or give him the $5.3 million a year and maybe have it for fewer than 5 years. But Jim Rutherford generally knows what he's doing.
Yep.
So we'll see if that contract ages well or not. The general manager that traded Patrick Hornquist to the Pittsburgh Penguins is David Poile. David Poile set the record for most career wins, regular season wins, by an NHL general manager, getting his 1,320th victory when the Predators beat the Oilers earlier on this week on Thursday. That, of course, being ironic because Poile passed Glenn Sather, former Oilers general manager, to move into top spot. Poile just now, I think, is getting maybe some of the recognition for just how good a general manager he is. He's always sort of been a little under the radar, maybe doesn't get the headlines, but certainly a bold general manager,
yep.
not afraid to make trades. And with the Predators playing as well as they have been for the last number of seasons, it maybe now is David Poile's time to shine.
Yeah, I agree with that, Drew. And remember 3 or 4 years ago, we were talking about how Nashville just couldn't go deep in the playoffs,
yeah.
and now they're a bona fide Stanley Cup contender, especially after going all the way to the Stanley Cup final last year. So I absolutely agree with, you know, David Poile is one of the best GMs in the NHL. He's up there with Ken Holland, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, some of the trades that he's made over the last couple of years, you think of Shea Weber for PK Subban, you think of Seth Jones for Ryan Johansson. Mm-hmm. He brought over Kyle Turris from the Ottawa Senators. I mean, he's made some big-time trades that have turned this team into, I believe, the best team in the league. So, you know, it's pretty amazing when you consider how many wins Poile has as a general manager. And, you know, if people aren't starting to recognize that, because I know that we haven't here on this show. I mean, we know how good of a person and a general manager he is. And I think, you know, by the time his career is over, he's going to go down as one of the best GMs ever.
Absolutely right. Well said there, Mr. Ginsburg. That's it for this Saturday morning edition of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to all of our guests, Anson Carter of NHL on NBC. We had Keith Gave, author of The Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage. John Forsland, Hurricanes broadcaster, and Scott Billick, Jets correspondent for NHL.com. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with latest Jets and Moose news is IllegalCurve.com. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get it sent to you automatically each and every week. For producer Rory, for Ezra Ginsburg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Next Saturday, 6 a.m. start for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, but we'll see you Wednesday for NHL This Week.